Death is universal. It touches all of us. Sooner or later, each one of us suffers the loss of a close relative, a friend, of acquaintances. And each one of us will confront our mortality in grieving for another, in recognition of our own fragility. Still, no other universal experience in this culture is met with less preparation, more avoidance, or greater distress. From KUAC FM in Fairbanks, I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. My guest today is Heather Anderson. She is currently the Regional Program Manager for the AIDS Education and Training Center at the University of Washington School of Medicine. She has worked in the area of terminal health care for the past decade. Heather, how do you think we approach death in America?
That's an interesting way to put the question, because I think we don't approach death in America. We retreat from it, or we hide from it. We hide death every opportunity we can. It's sort of like my famous Woody Allen line, which is, I don't mind dying, I just don't want to be there when it happens. And that really is the way a lot of us feel about it. And unless we have a personal experience where we've been with a family member when they've died, or a good friend through a hospice program, for example, then we have a whole sort of a reawakening or an enlightened experience of it. Otherwise, we have such tremendous fear of it that we deny that it's going to happen to us or anyone we love and care about, or we think that's somewhere down the road and we can't see that it could be around the corner.
You've thought about this issue a lot. Why do you suppose in this culture we keep death at least at arm's length, if not further?
I think that part of it is our goal-oriented society, that for us to plan for something that isn't predictable doesn't seem to make sense to our culture. So if we, you know, if we can't outline the five steps, four stages, whatever, to reach that goal, we just can't imagine it happening to us. I think that it's partly that, as our culture is so vigorously opposed to it. Also, we have no role models, no one who has really stood out for us as a culture and said, look at this, there's another way to do it. So somebody who would normalize dying. If you look at our culture, you can see all kinds of ways that makes death what I call the glorification or gorification. You know, we have all the movies, what are we up to now, Halloween 10 or whatever we're at now, with making death something ugly and gory and
frightening,
violent. Or else we glorify it, where we see TV death or movie death, like Steel Magnolias. While that was a wonderful movie, the death looked relatively painless. You know, her breathing stopped, and there wasn't, you know, a lot of real true film telling the story in film. What that woman must have gone through, the family, and a whole nother level, we didn't see it. So we really don't have a good model for us to realize that death is normal, happens to all of us, and there are things we can do to prepare for it. And I always like to tell people when I'm doing training is that people die like they live. And finally, if the group is a pretty sophisticated group to work with, they'll all of a sudden see, aha, what we do right now is the best preparation for our own death. And if we're going to die like we live, if we're angry, if we're short-tempered, if we're sort of live a life of chaos, that's how our death is going to be as well. And so trying to get our affairs in order starts right now. It doesn't start when you get the notice from your physician or whoever that you have a week or two left or a month or two.
You've mentioned the way Hollywood looks at movies. Are there taboos related to death which come from other major cultural institutions? Religion, mm-hmm. patriotism, nationalism?
Well, I think that certainly death in war is another example of how we glorify it. That we never tell young recruits, for example, what death is about, what death's going to be like on the battlefield. Until this recent Vietnam series of wars like Full Metal Jacket or Born on the 4th of July, we really didn't even have a good sense, or certainly there was before that, what was the one that was before that that was so good?
Platoon.
Yeah, Platoon and the Killing Fields. But if you think of World War II films that spun off out of that, or Korea, that was another way to glorify it. And so people who have avoided those war movies, the current bunch of them, I'm sure can sign up with their recruiter and not really think about what their kinds of deaths, not only that they're putting themselves at risk for, but what kind of death they'll inflict on others, that we, whoever we might name as the enemy.
Our religious institutions christen us when we are infants and bury us when we die, mm-hmm. and also comfort the grieving. Do you think our religious institutions assist people in recognizing and accepting death?
I think that's a good issue when we're talking about people living like they, dying like they live. If religion has been a comfort to you, and your idea that at the end of this life you'll go to a greater reward, for example, the concept of heaven and hell for the Christian ideology, then for a lot of people that notion or that belief system helps them through that dying process. I know that a woman who was very much like a second mother to me, who died a year ago, April, was a very devout Catholic. And for her, this suffering that she experienced, she died of pancreatic cancer, the suffering that she experienced towards the end, she felt made her feel closer to her Godhead, or her vision of the perfect being, which was Christ, that actually unified her with that being and gave her strength. And the notion that that was actually going to maybe, in her notion of purgatory, perhaps maybe even make a quicker transition from life to heaven. So for her, that was very comforting. For people who are not churched, that what we have heard, or what has filtered down to us, or what we still retain from our childhood, can make death actually more fearful. The notion of hell, the idea of an angry, for many people, certainly picked up the idea that there would be an angry God to judge us. And if we haven't been, whatever good means, if we haven't been good, then we won't get the reward. And so that idea of feeling guilty when you die, and that you somehow haven't measured up to this criteria that you are going to end up the rest of your life burning in hell, I think causes a lot of people to be real traumatized at the moment of death, or at least they have to work through that. Mm-hmm. So what religion sort of is a good news, bad news story. And I think that for many people there has to be some coming to terms with it. Almost everybody has to come to some peace with what the existential question, why me, why now, why this way, and what's going to happen to me after I die.
You're listening to Conversations, and we're talking with Heather Anderson today. Ms. Anderson has spent over a decade working with people who are dying. She has worked in the recent years in the AIDS movement, worked in nursing, dealing with people who have AIDS and families of people who are HIV positive and who have AIDS. She gained her master's in nursing from the Department of Community Healthcare Systems at the School of Nursing at the University of Washington in Seattle, Washington. I wonder if also our self-perception as a youthful culture is mm-hmm. something that blocks our ability to understand that we may also die as individuals.
Mm-hmm. I think you're absolutely right, and I think that's one of the things with this AIDS epidemic that has thrown all of us, is that all of a sudden youth doesn't protect us, that the vast majority of people dying in this epidemic, and as you know, we've passed the 100,000 mark this week, are in their 20s, 30s, and early 40s that are dying with this. And we go to great lengths to think that youth, that being young or the youthful image will protect us. People dye their hair, people wear makeup, or the cosmetic industry has been built on trying to look younger. It's not just women who do the supposedly vain activities of all of this, but men also. I mean, there's a whole makeup line for men now. There's a whole the Grecian formula to take the gray out of your hair. There's ways we can continually to go to health spas and work out, not because we will feel better necessarily, but we will look younger, and we will sort of keep that death at that arm's length as long as we can fool it by thinking that we're really not as old as we might be. And we also hide the aged in nursing homes, whether it's because of our fear of growing old and we don't want to see it. That may be part of it, and also the way our economy is, that the two-member households having to work, it's hard to afford them to stay at home and take care of them. But we certainly do use institutions as a way to hide the elderly from us. It's not the European model where we would have three generations living in one household. Again, that not having those three generations in the one household denies the youngest generation from watching the natural progression. And as we become more and more urbanized, we don't see it in our, you know, the old growing up on a farm idea where you could see death as part of the whole routine on managing a farm. We really lost touch with that as we become a more urbanized or industrialized population.
You've raised something indirectly that I'd like to look at directly. Medical science in the past couple of decades has just outdone itself in its ability to deal with illness, deal with crisis, and to prolong life. What impact has that had on our understanding of death?
Well, my belief, and I'm not sure that there's a lot of research to back it up, but it seems to be logical to me that we have spent so much money in research on prolonging life and so little on sustaining the quality of it for people. I'm thinking, great, now we can have people live, you know, another, in the last 20 years we may, or 50 years may have extended life, another 5 years for people. But look at what the life is like for that. Those individuals, if they are not independently wealthy, they struggle economically, their health while they're still alive, their health, they have all kinds of increased health risks. Cancer, for example, would be a number one killer for people. But now we can make that a slower death because we've managed to prolong people's lives even while they have a diagnosis of cancer. So you talk to older people and they say, you know, really, when it comes to my time to go, I don't want all the heroics. I don't want to have a feeding tube inserted. I don't want to have a respirator put on. I don't want to have infection after infection treated. I want nature to take its course. But because we're such a litigious society, the worry of hospitals and other institutions of being sued if that's followed out is pretty great. And you can see right now where we're fighting those battles all around the country of not of just allowing people to die naturally. And I think we're going to have to go through another series of court battles to give the individual the right not to. I'm not talking suicide. I'm not talking euthanasia. I'm talking, or active euthanasia. I'm talking about allowing people to decide when they no longer want modern medicine and its miracles to court disaster for them. And it's incredibly hard to take people off dialysis, for example, if they're having kidney failure. It's terribly hard to take them off of that, and it'd be much easier if we could just listen to people when they say, don't put me on it. Now, a lot of physicians who may be listening to this may say, it's not that simple. And that's true, because for a lot of people, it's their families that push to have this on. And so what my physician told me when I went in and interviewed her to see if I wanted to have her be my personal physician, I asked her her feelings around living wills and how much she would support my decision about at what point I would no longer want active treatment. And she said she was fine with all of that, but from this day on, every time I saw my parents, I would have to sit down with them and tell them that story, that this is what I want, this is where I want the limits to be placed, this is my physician, this is how I want you to interact. And so I did that for the next about four visits to my parents until it made them a little nervous, but I think they got the message. And I invited my parents to share the same information with me of what do they want. And it's really interesting. They're both in their 70s now, and maybe it's because of my specialty in death and dying, but they're a little reluctant to be too direct with me. But they do both say that they have living wills drawn up and that their attorney has it. But I think it is harder for them in their 70s to really talk about that, and especially the fear for them is which one will go first. And they're actually celebrating their 50th wedding anniversary next month. So, I mean, they have a lot of fear around losing each other. And I think if I could get them to talk privately with me instead of together, it might be easier. But I think for that population, I think that it's a mixed bag. They don't want, a lot of them don't want this prolongation, but the families have a hard time letting go, too.
How can people broach the subject with each other if they've never talked about it before? Mm-hmm. Child to parent, parent to child, husband to wife, and vice versa.
Right. I think that partly my thoughts on that would be that we're struggling to make it normal And so to talk about it as a course of everyday living, when and there's all kinds of opportunities presenting itself. There's news, then, you know, what's on television or in the paper, families, friends, we hear about death. And instead of just having it be a subject that we don't talk about with the children, or we wait till the children are in bed and then we'll talk about it, to start bringing it up. And kids think about it, kids talk about it. And it only makes it seem abnormal when all of a sudden they walk in the room and it's hushed. And to invite children to ask, to invite children to tell you what they think about it and how they think about it. I know I have nieces and nephews who are in their teens now, but ever since they were, you know, 8, 9, 10, I've always been fascinated with how kids put this together. And so instead of me telling them what I think, I've just drawn it out from them to let me tell, you know, let them tell me how they've sorted it out for themselves and why they think people die at a young age, how they think people, what happens to people after they die. It's incredibly interesting to hear how kids view this.
What were some of their thoughts?
Well, I love the one most recently. I have a really young niece who said, this was right around Christmas time, where her vision of this happening was that there was a great communication system set up, and that God saw everything you did and told Santa Claus, which I thought was a great way to view this. But then in talking to her about what happens to you after you die, children have... the younger ones I talk to are very comfortable with the notion of reincarnation, that you have more than one time around, even children raised in households where that's not the dominant belief system. And it just seems to make sense that the cycle of birth and death that they see around them, that they've been able to put that together, and that a fair way to go about it might be to have another crack at this. And I found that really interesting as I talk to younger children. As they get a little older, I think that the culture pretty much, in this, at least in our Western culture, pretty much takes that out of them. And then they begin to this, they really see this dichotomy of heaven and hell and one life, one judgment in that. And another way a lot of kids talk about it is there's this suspended time which is interesting, even in households that don't have this purgatory notion that the Catholic Church does, that there's a time of suspension where you're sort of in just in nothingness for a while. And some children think that nothing happens to you after you die, that you just cease to exist. And I find that sort of sad.
Mm-hmm. What is your notion of an afterlife?
You know, I was raised in a very conservative, a traditional Presbyterian home. I was a ruling elder in the Presbyterian Church when I was 18. I was very connected in that Christian background, and still have a lot of belief system in my, a lot of beliefs from that in that I incorporated into my current belief system. But as I worked with people who were dying, no matter what tradition they came from, the more and more I worked with them, and again, some people might argue, well, she's adopted this because it's helped her cope, and maybe so, but I'm very comfortable with the notion that we do have more than one life, and that instead of thinking, well, this means, you know, do whatever you want, you'll have another chance, you know, this sort of devil may care attitude, knowing that you...
this one's free.
Right, that you can clean up next life and be good next life and live like a hellion this life. Instead of that, I think it adds an extra responsibility, and I'll tell you one way for me that it plays itself out is if I have a person in this life that I'm having an incredibly difficult time getting along with, like they're just driving me crazy, I can't seem, no point of connection with them. I think if I don't work it out with them this life, I'm going to have to do it next life, and it might be even more difficult. So it actually makes me more responsible. And I find that true with other people who share that belief system, that it's a growth process. We're always moving upward, and it doesn't, you know, the goal isn't to try to fool anybody and get a freebie. The goal is to continue to grow and broaden as a human being and increase in our capacity to love. And I think that's why we're here. And I've been really honored to be able to do this work with people who are dying, because they've taught me so much around what's essential in life. Because by the time you get down to your last few months of life, you've really let go of a lot of the inconsequential, and you're really focused on, I think, matters of the heart. And it's taught me a lot, and I think it's made me more mature. I know that when I started doing this in my 20s, I had a head nurse who described me as 20 going on 40, and I think it did mature me rather quickly. I started doing caring for people who were terminally ill when I was 16, working in a nursing home, and then continued to do that for the last 21 years.
This is the, what you've just talked about is the meaning behind all of life is, what's the phrase? All of life is rehearsal for death. To find meaning in life and thus meaning in death, and so the circle will be full, is that?
Absolutely, and I think one of your opening comments struck a chord for me in the sense that people can't really, I don't believe, live fully till they've had some connection with their own limitation or their own mortality. And so this notion that I'm only here, whether it's at best 70, 80 years, then let's make the best of that. Let's make the most of that. And let's keep that consciousness that, you know, none of us are getting out alive, and we're all going to have to take the most from this time. And so I really have found that the people I connect with and the people I find most interesting, at least to me, are people who have had some reminder in their life that that this is a very short and very fast 70-odd years that we might have.
A reminder that you're listening to Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes, your host for KUAC-FM in Fairbanks. My guest today is Heather Anderson. She is a nurse, has been working with people who are terminally ill, as she has just said, for the past 20 years. Currently, Heather is a lecturer for the School of Social Work at the University of Washington, also a lecturer for the School of Nursing at that school, and a core faculty member for the Northwest AIDS Education and Training Center, also in Seattle. You said the other day within my earshot, I have an interest in suffering and how it changes us. And you have touched on that briefly in this conversation, but I'd like you to concentrate on it for a moment for us.
Actually, the AIDS epidemic brought that to my attention in a way that I'd never seen it in all the years I'd done cancer care. And I began to wonder, with this intense kind of suffering that we see with a person dying from AIDS, how does that change the caregiver, whether it's a family member or whether it's the hired paid, the paid caregiver or the healthcare professional? How does watching someone who is our own age or the age of our children die very terrible deaths? These, you know, AIDS deaths, I think, while we know more and more about how to allay symptoms, still, an AIDS death has very little grace to it, in the sense that so many body systems can be involved. They can have skin lesions that are open and weeping and are very tender for them, painful. They can have disfiguring Kaposi sarcoma lesions, which are raised purplish lesions that can cover the entire upper trunk and the face. They can have the lesions, Kaposi's lesions around the eyes, causing swelling around the eyes and be blind. They can have neurological damages in which they appear much like Alzheimer's patients. They can have other neurological problems that will make them unable to move their extremities. And so you go in and you see this 20-year-old who is also maybe wasted away from 180 pounds down to 60, curled up in a fetal position. You think, my God, you know, what has the difference that I'm standing here providing services to them and they're lying in that bed dying? And the suffering that you watch this client go through, and especially as you follow them over the years or months that they are going through this, and then you watch their families and watch what the family goes through, and I'm talking about both their family of choice, their lover, circle of friends, or else their family of origin, their parents and siblings and children oftentimes their spouse. You watch the suffering they go through, and I got to thinking, what will this do over the long haul? How will this change us? And then I began to talk to healthcare providers, and my own experience of supervising the staff, that was what they did. Their full-time job was working with people who were dying either from AIDS or other life-threatening illness. And I began to listen to them talk about the meaning they gave the suffering they watched. And So I do now workshops with healthcare professionals just talking about the issue of suffering and help them discover the meaning that they give to suffering. Because for many of us in healthcare, we were trained that death is the enemy, that suffering is the enemy, there's nothing good that comes out of it, it only needs to be relieved. And if you can't relieve it, then you have failed as a practitioner. Death is the ultimate enemy, and for physicians, if a patient dies, for many physicians, they see that as the ultimate failure. And so the workshops I do with providers then is a chance where they can sit down and really think about, maybe for the first time, their exposure to suffering. And it's fascinating because, I was a head nurse on an oncology unit that primarily worked with cancer patients, and I never remember once when we sit down for change of shift report and we would talk among ourselves, no one ever said, boy, I saw a lot of suffering today. We didn't even have a concept of it. And yet when you look at nurses, for example, and social workers who see, feel, hold, touch, smell suffering at a degree very few other human beings do, you'd compare them to people who work in the world of finance or who work in the world of law, for example. Very different. And yet nurses and social workers seem unaware of that. And so then I draw their attention, well, how has this changed you? And for some of them, they may say, I become more cynical. Some of them say, I have a harder, I love it when some nurses say, my kids have to be really sick before I give them the attention. Or all of a sudden, life takes on a little different meaning when people are complaining about not being able to get the kind of seltzer that they want. Or, they change their priorities or their perspective on life. Deepens and widens because of their exposure to this. And then you work, and I certainly have done this with myself, work another level down to what does this mean for you personally? Why are you working so close to this whole issue of suffering? And, that's where it's a real hard one is it because you think you can do something to comfort them and that maybe you have a gift not to fix it, not to rescue them from this, but that you can bear witness to it. And I think that, when I first thought about it, I thought about an article I could write called The Burden of Witness. And then I thought, no, it's not always a burden, but it's more important that we bear witness, that we don't run away or turn away from it, that some people just need someone to be with them through that. And it sounds easy, but it's very hard. It's very hard when your whole professional training has been to fix it, clean it up, get it moved on, and get another case in, to just sit with someone while they're in that, if you want to use a Christian tradition, you could talk, when they're in the garden, the Garden of Gethsemane, when Christ was going through his agonizing moment and his decision about what suffering he may have to go through and would eventually. So, it's sort of that, how much can you sit on your hands and still stay open-hearted? Henry Nouwen has a beautiful quote about, if you can sit in silence with your fellow man, not knowing what to say, but knowing that you should be there, you can, to paraphrase him, he talks about how you can break through those paralyzing boundaries that we all set up with each other, and that you can start a new fellowship, the fellowship of the broken. And I think that's the place we have to get to connect with other people who are suffering, that it connects also with our place of brokenness. And in that moment is when healing occurs. So the hopefulness, people say, how can you offer AIDS patients hope, or how can you offer people who are dying of cancer hope? The hope one has then is that they have that healing, not of a cure perhaps, but that healing of the spirit that can happen in those last days or months of life. If they have an opportunity to sit with someone who, in an open-hearted way, who can truly stay there with them through that.
The question I haven't asked is, what do you think is the healthiest approach to death, or the mm-hmm. concept of death, mm-hmm. before it comes to the door?
That's an interesting one, the healthiest approach. It's sort of like normal grieving. Whatever you're doing is normal in that range, and a healthy death is a death, I suppose, that Henry Wiseman, I'm blocking on his first name now, who did so much writing on death and dying, he really talked about the appropriate death. And he said an appropriate death is a death you would choose for yourself if you could. And I think, boy, that is powerful, because many of us have an idea in our head of what an appropriate death for us would be. And it's important, and I do workshops with healthcare providers. I often have them fill out this little questionnaire, to themselves. They don't have to show it to anybody. But I have them say, at what age would you want to die? At what age would be appropriate for you to die? Where would you have that death occur? Would it be at home? Would it be at a hospital? Where would you want that death to occur? Would you want it to happen to you while you're out fishing, while you're out hunting, while you're out, whatever, golfing? When, how, who would you want to be there with you? Would you want to be alone? Would you want a healthcare provider with you? Would you want your family there? And how much notice would you want? Would you want to have 3 months' notice? Would you want a month? Would you want only an hour? Would you want no warning at all? Would you want it to happen in your sleep? Very few people say, I want long, drawn-out, agonizing death, of course. But then I ask the next question is, what's your most feared death? And we all have that, too. We just, oftentimes it's difficult for us to sit with it long enough to really put it down on paper. But if you put down your most idealized death and your most feared death, you'll see where, when someone in your life chooses a death that looks like your most feared death, it's very hard to allow them, Avery Wiseman's notion of an appropriate death. It's very hard. For example, I had a woman in my past clinical practice who was dying of esophageal cancer, and this is probably my best example of my own block in this. And she had lost, due to the rapidly growing tumor, she was no longer able to swallow fluids any longer. And even her own secretions, she had to use a Kleenex for her saliva. Then the tumor was growing so rapidly that it was now beginning to close off her trachea or her windpipe. And now for me, my most feared death, next to dying in a car accident on the freeway, was to die of suffocation, which is the slow way this woman was going. She wanted no treatment. She wanted no fluids to be given IV. She wanted to die alone. And this was sort of the picture, and she was only in her 50s. This was my picture of my most feared death. And so I went to her home, and from the day I met her till she died was only 5 days. And she spent a long time talking with me through, with great difficulty and having to write someone. She got too tired to try to talk through that blocked trachea. She would describe what she thought was the next life for her, how she thought this was a learning process, what she'd learned this life, how she was ready. She was probably one of the most at-peace people I've ever worked with in this. And I know for me, a little voice kept saying, this is horrible. How can she do this? But I was able to support her right to die at home, or her choice to die at home, because that was what I would want. And when it came to then her last day of life, I stopped by her apartment and I told her it was going to be very soon, probably in the next few hours. And I said, even at that point, I said, I've got my toothbrush in the car. I can come up and be with you during these last hours. And she was so dear. She said through a very, very raspy voice, she said, Heather, you're not listening to me. And at that moment, I thought, how could she say I'm not listening to her? I have my master's degree in this. Hey. And then I thought, she's absolutely right. And the reason I couldn't hear her for those 5 days I worked with her was because it was such my most feared notion that I would die alone. Amazingly enough, now that woman taught me more in those 5 days about how I could die alone with dignity and grace and a solidness that I didn't realize I had. And so she taught me that, gave me that incredible gift that I'm not so afraid now of dying alone. And also I was able to respect her wishes to make that possible for her as well. And I left her at that time and came back the next morning. And indeed she had died. And of course, what did I do? The first thing I looked for was to see if she'd changed her mind, if she tried to reach the phone or anything, and she hadn't. The covers were still tucked in. And I'm really proud of both of us in that situation, that she was able to stay with her solidness and her integrity around how she wanted it to be, and I was able to struggle with my own issues around that and allow her the death that was appropriate for her. And in the course of that, I learned a lot about myself, which is the ultimate learning for all of us.
I want you to back up for just a minute. You mm-hmm. talked about asking fellow nurses to describe their most, what they felt was the most appropriate death and the one they feared most. Since death is something that we can't choose unless we choose suicide, mm-hmm. what does the exercise do?
Well, it points out for us how we block other people, like my example with this woman.
Right.
But, you know, your comment, we can't choose it. I don't agree with that 100%. And while suicide, I suppose, is the ultimate control of your own death, I do think we have a great deal of control about how we die. I think it's amazing that so many people die on anniversary dates, their birth dates. Very few people die on Christmas Day. I think the time of death, I've watched people hang on for days beyond when I would ever think they would able to survive that physiologically, until a family member came to their hospital. Or a gentleman I'll never forget hung on in the ICU after we've stopped the respirator and everything, hung on until midnight, 12:01 of the day he needed to live to for an insurance policy to be enacted for his family. I know that I've worked with couples who've been married for years, and they just can't die when the other one's in the room. So, you know, I'm sure those listening to this program won't be able to conjure up some memory of somebody who's told them, you know, I was with my husband for the weeks and months up until his death, and then I just left for an hour or two to get my hair fixed or to go grocery shopping, and he died when I was away. And I've seen that happen so often that when I worked in hospice, I often would tell the spouse that, you know, that oftentimes people can't die when you're here. The connection is so strong that if you go away to do an errand or whatever, are you okay with the fact that he or she may die while you're gone? And it's so much better to be able to help prepare them for that, because there's a lot of guilt thinking, geez, I was there for all of this, mm-hmm. but I couldn't be there at the end for him, when really going away and giving them that freedom to then die when they're not there was a gift to give them. And that, you know, the notion that we often have to wait till we get permission from significant others that it's okay to die, we don't have to struggle anymore, we don't have to keep fighting, that I think we have a lot more control than we think we do around the moment of death and in the manner in which we'll die.
Okay, so how do we begin to break through, get to know, I assume, and then break through our own fears and taboos relative to the subject of death, so that we can move into a position to befriend it and therefore have that consciousness, yeah. whether it's a matter of control or a matter of just consciousness to go through it, as the mm-hmm. woman you described.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting. I think I am so, my perspective is so skewed, I may not be the best person to answer that question any longer, because death is so much a part of my living now. I guess I could think about it in terms of my own personal relationships, of when I talk with my parents or my partner about death and the fact that someday we will be separated by that. I can only hold that consciousness for a very brief time. And I guess I would just encourage us to be brave and take those times. And often I use those as opportunities to give appreciation or to talk about the love and I have for that person, and how I enjoy being in life with them, and how much I would miss them not being together. I think about a friend of mine who's, again, a woman who was very much like my second mom who died. There were two lessons she taught me in her gracious dying that I will carry with me forever. One was her daughter and I were sitting in her bedroom, and that woman asked me, how long do you think I have left, Heather? And I said, and the daughter has her, we met in graduate school, so we both gave her a response and said, this was like on Wednesday or so, and I said, I think it will be by Friday or Saturday. I think it's that close. And she sat back in the chair and she said she thought that too, and she thanked us for being that honest with her. And she got a phone call from a family member she wasn't all that fond of, and who wanted to come visit. And she told the person at the phone, she says, tell him to come on Sunday, which I thought was wonderful and gracious and still keeping control of who she wanted to be there and how she wanted that to happen. And another incident with the same woman was when the daughter and I were in the room with her, and the daughter was saying how much she loved her and how much she was going to miss her. And it was one of the most naked conversations I'd seen between family members. And the daughter was saying, you know, that it hadn't always been easy in their relationship, but that she was so glad they'd had the last few months to work things out as much as they had. And the mother looked at the daughter and said, you know, how much she loved her. And then she said, well, you know, I'm going to miss you. Well, and then she stopped and looked kind of puzzled. She said, well, I don't know if I'll miss you or not. And I thought, how wonderfully honest. And when you get to that level, death ceases to be this morbid, fearful, awful thing, and there's humor in it, and there's a life in it that is almost that. It's such a juxtaposition to have those two held together, but it's like laughing and crying at the same time. With when you're open-hearted about it, versus when you're so afraid that you can't talk about it, it's only painful. Mm-hmm. And the most pain that people experience is that in denial, holding back, being tight, not wanting to talk about it, and that pain is so deep and lasts a long time and makes the grieving process after the death much longer than this pain that you can experience, and it's like a wall you can just walk through, versus when you're bottled up and blocking on it, it's a wall you just keep hitting. I guess that's how I would describe it in a visual way.
Once again, this is Conversations, and we're talking to Heather Anderson. Ms. Anderson has written extensively on the subject of death, especially as relates to AIDS, and writings to assist nurses and other professionals as they help people cope with their dying. Once again, she is currently the regional program manager with the Northwest Regional AIDS Education and Training Center, that training center located at the University of Washington Medical School. I'm Susan McGinnis. You're listening to Conversations. Many people have great difficulty being with someone who is ill, who is terminally ill. And it strikes me sometimes that people who are terminally ill are frequently viewed as neither alive nor dead.
Sort of in that suspended state of living, dying, which is interesting. We're going to see that even more with AIDS, the AIDS epidemic, as people live longer and AIDS becomes a chronic illness. We'll see that you'll have a life-threatening illness, but are you living with it or are you dying with it? And you sort of become this social piranha. Is that the right word?
Pariah.
Pariah, thank you. Where no one really wants to be with you, because you are the living symbol of this death, this idea of death that we want to escape from, and no one knows what to say to you. And we're so in this culture, you know, we're worried about saying the wrong thing, about appearing foolish, appearing inept, that we seldom step back and say, maybe I should just ask that person. So for many of us, when we say, geez, I don't know what to do, or we react with guilt, we say, oh, I'd love to have gone to visit that person in the hospital, but I just didn't want to go because I didn't know what to say. That this going anyway, walking through that and admitting that we're new at this, most of us have had very little experience with death, and to say to the person, I'm really uncomfortable, I don't know, I just want to tell you how concerned I am, or how sad I am, or I just like to maybe just go out with you and go to a movie and not talk about it and give you a little vacation, but I want you to know I want to be here in whatever way I can. And then to follow up on that and mean that when you say it too. I think that our ability to just be vulnerable, to appear foolish, you know, that E.E. Cummings said, whoever pays any attention to the syntax of things will never wholly kiss you. Holy to be a fool, you know, my blood approves. You know, to be fully alive is to be able to be foolish, mm-hmm. and to say, you're going to have to teach me. And in this death stuff, it's like no one wants to admit we don't know about it, and yet where have we had a chance to learn about it? Death education classes were sort of a big thing in the late 60s, early 70s, and they somehow have dropped from current popularity. But I think that it may come back for us again through perhaps this AIDS epidemic, which brings death into our midst. And with passing this 100,000 mark this week, I can't imagine that AIDS isn't going to touch every one of us in some way. If you think of those 100,000, every one of them had two parents, have some children, perhaps siblings, caregivers, lovers, wives. It's going to, you know, the ripple effect is certainly getting large enough now. And that will force us to have to at least look at our own issues, I think. Maybe I'm a little too hopeful. But we'll have to at least have us start thinking about people dying and people dying at a young age, that we haven't had to deal with since the polio epidemic in this country.
I want to talk about grieving for a moment. It seems to me that some people in society have difficulties grieving. some because of cultural pressures, mothers who lose infants have difficulty grieving openly, mm-hmm. it seems to me anyway. Mm-hmm. Gay men whose lovers have died from AIDS, difficult to say, my lover has died, and without exposing yourself terribly. Mm-hmm. Men, I would think, have a difficult time grieving for other cultural reasons. It's not manly to do that.
Right.
Are those blocks common for everyone, or is it subculturally specific to?
I think our whole culture has a nice little built-in anti-grief device, if you will. We think we'll give you until after the funeral, and then we're tired of it. You know,
but some of the books say it can take 5 years to get over a 40, 50-year marriage.
Absolutely.
Marriage.
In fact, in the early days when we were doing a lot of work in grief, people would say you need at least 1 or 2 years. Now, people are finally realizing sometimes you never recover in that sense of return to normal, whatever that is, but that you're never back to what you were before in that sense. And if you think about significant losses, it has changed you. It becomes sort of incorporated into the fabric of who you are. It becomes less painful. It becomes perhaps less energy draining for you, yes. But it never really goes away. And I think that to help people realize that makes them feel more normal, like they're not somehow needing to feel guilty that they somehow didn't grieve normally. So I think the culture at large, you know, bereavement leave from jobs is, what, maybe a week, as if you could get over a significant loss in a week and be back on the job. Maybe some more compassionate companies will give you a month off. But in any event, it may not be enough. And for some, they want to go right back to work as a way to work through it and then take their time off later. And most programs aren't that flexible. So we have this overarching sort of get it over with before, right after the funeral, and then no one comes to visit the person, or the numbers drop off significantly. So there's that, and then there are the subcultural specifics, the differences by gender, by age. I think of the parents right now who are losing children to AIDS is a good example of ways we inhibit grieving. One of the ways we inhibit grieving by is that we make it the loss socially unspeakable. And AIDS is a good example of that. I talk to many parents who live in communities like Fairbanks who say, you know, my son moved away, California, New York, wherever, and is dying now, or has died, I can't tell my friends about it. I have to make up some story. And I've had many parents say, what else could I tell my friends my son died of? Could I say he died of a brain tumor? Could I say he died of cancer? Just don't make me have to tell them he died from AIDS. So this stigma with that prolongs the grieving process where they have to hide. The loss is socially unspeakable. Another thing that inhibits grieving is when the loss is socially negated. And your example of a man losing his male lover, that is socially negated oftentimes because they've either lived together as, quotes, roommates. And so you can't say this was the most important person in my life, someone I loved deeply, we had a committed relationship, and I can't tell you about that. So what you see at work or what you say at work is, oh, your roommate died. Mm-hmm. And then you let it go, or too bad, or it must be tough. But you don't get the same social support as perhaps a married, a heterosexual couple would get. And certainly as our definition of significant relationships are broadening, and not everybody goes into the heterosexual marriage either, we're seeing that harder and harder to get social recognition of major losses. Another example would be a parent who loses a child. I think that is hard for people, an adult child is hard for people to really understand that loss too. For the adult, the parent losing an adult child, they lose a big chunk of their future. Who's going to take care of them? Maybe they were hoping that they would get some financial support or social support from their child in their old age. They lose that. They also lose the idealized version of their child, especially if this child, they didn't know their child was gay or they didn't know their child was an IV drug user, and then they find out that this is how they contracted the virus. And so then they have to deal with not only the loss of that child physical loss, but then the loss of who they thought that child was. Then you have conflicted grief, which is another type of grief that is prolonged, is when you have this love-hate relationship with the object or the person who's died. So, you know, you love your son, but you're mad as hell at him for whatever risky behavior may have brought the virus to him, or your daughter. Why did she marry that guy? That guy was no good from the beginning, and now he's infected her with the AIDS virus, and I'm mad as hell at her, and I love her dearly. How can you work on that, those two feelings at the same time while you're trying to go through your own grief process? So that's another inhibitor to grief. Also, there's the grief overload, which I'm seeing a lot in this epidemic, and I see it in the circle of friends who are caring for someone who's dying. They probably have cared for four or five other friends who have died from this disease. They've not had 5 years to fully recover as fully as they can recover before the next loss. They may have had that loss only a month ago. Parents also have this bereavement overload where parents who are in their 60s or 70s losing a child, they're losing their peer group to death and various diseases. And they're going through their own grief process about the limitations they may be having in their life due to their aging. And so they have all these little losses, not necessarily death, but all these other social losses that they're going through. Then the death losses, and then they lose their child. Now, talk about bereavement overload with that population. How are we going to offer services to them to help them through the grief process? Are you going to have and I don't mean to stereotype, but a good example might be, how are you going to get a 65-year-old male to come to a support group to talk with other 65-year-old males about their son that died in New York who was a gay man? How are they, you know, that's not going to be their choice of mental health support. So how are we going to design systems to reach out to that population? It's going to be, I think, a real challenge. So, and another thing is a community with grief. When you're talking about whole communities that grieve, and you'll see this more and more as small communities start losing key people who they had no idea were infected with the virus. So community grief is going to be something that we're going to have to do more work on. And I think of in cities like New York and Miami, Los Angeles, where people in, let's say, the gay community, because that's been probably hit the hardest. It's certainly not isolated to the gay community, but the gay community who want to memorialize, let's say, three people at one service because you can't get off work enough to go to three funerals in 1 week. And so you'll have one service to remember the three individuals. I think this is social loss at a level we've not had to deal with, except perhaps in times of war.
Come around to the other side of what you have been saying. You've talked about what inhibits grief, mm-hmm. and what exacerbates it, what makes it worse and worse. What facilitates the grieving process as some sort of resolution?
I'm a real firm believer in anticipatory grief. Grief that we can actually express and experience before the death occurs. My example of the friend of mine telling her daughter how much she loved her and that she would, well, miss her if it was possible to miss her. That kind of open exchange of sadness and grief, I think, takes months off the whole grieving process. So that we would confront it early, that we would, again, walk through that wall. Now, how do you do that? It's hard to do that alone. And it's very helpful to do that with someone who has assisted other people through that. So you could go to your hospice programs. You could go to, if your program has a grief and loss support groups. Sometimes the American Cancer Society might offer those. But if you could start talking about it, and you don't have to even talk to a professional about it necessarily. You can talk to anyone who's also suffered a loss. And if you're the person who's offering the listening ear, I think the biggest challenge there is to be quiet and let that person tell their story. I've sat so many times and listened to people say, oh, that was terrible, but let me tell you my story. And, you know, that is very little support. I've also heard, you know, you mentioned young women who've lost babies of having problems with grieving and reaching out for support. I can really see why they might have trouble. Some of the comforting things they tell me they've heard from people at their churches or others is, you know, things that are not very helpful.
Don't worry, you can have another.
Exactly. Don't worry, you'll have another one. God must have loved your baby so much that he called him to him, you know, right away. Whatever. And these are things that when we hear them, we say, oh, no one would say that. But we know people do say that. And so, you know, if we could just let, again, I think that's a way to cover up, you know, and put that grieving person away, get them, you know, push them back, say some platitude so that they don't look so nakedly in pain in front of us. Because to see them in pain makes us have to look at our own pain that we don't want to deal with. So what helps grieving, I guess, is time and being able to talk about it, being able to just allow ourselves the luxury, if you will, of just weeping. For many of us, we want to hold it in, or we'll only allow ourselves a few minutes every day to release that, if that. But to allow ourselves to weep with someone who will just hold us, who will not try to fix it for us, who will just let us do that, not have to do a big long story about it, and then just move on. And I'm encouraged sometimes when I'm invited into workplaces to talk about grief with work groups when they've lost a key member of the staff. A law firm just a while ago asked me to come in and talk to them. And I'm encouraged by the kind of outreach that's done at workplaces now, where people will say, geez, you know, I spend a lot of time with this guy. We work together. That's more time than I spend with my family, for many people. And I want to recognize that this is a significant loss for me, too. So to have workplace support around our grief issues, I think that's something we'll see more and more in the years to come.
Do you think, this goes back to the 60s, but do you think it's important to feel how you feel? And that's a more complex question than it sounds. Many people feel angry when someone they love has died, resentful when sometimes people feel relief that that person, and many, those what we think of as dark emotions for the time make us feel guilty. But
thank you, Susan. That's a really good point that I've kind of focused on the sorrow part of this. But grief has so many faces that it's almost the whole spectrum of human emotions. The anger is a great example. I love my husband so much, but I am so mad that he went first. We had this deal, our whole marriage, I was going to go first. How could he? You know, the old cliche, I love the old cliche is, the, you know, the who, you know, when you just, you know, you can always tell true love in a couple by, you say, well, who's going to go first, you know? And the person, you know, well, I'll let you go first because then you won't have to suffer the loss of me. But, you know, that so there is that. And then there's, with the anger, there's the guilt, you know, to how can you be mad at somebody who's dead or mad at somebody who's dying? So then people have to deal with the guilt. It would be much simpler if we could just accept that this is normal. You can be relieved. Heavens, after working, and as I've watched couples support each other through this whole process, who wouldn't be relieved? You've watched them suffer. You've worked and lost sleep yourself. You've been, maybe for months, been that primary caregiver for that person. And it's finally over. You can finally say it's over and get on with the next stage of grieving. So relief is a big part. And again, people feel guilty about that. So sort of in my belief that guilt is a wasted emotion, that if we could just accept, like you say, feel what we're feeling and realize that we can feel sorrow, we can feel relief, we can feel anger, we can feel joy, and that's all part of this whole package of facing death in a more open-hearted fashion.
Heather Anderson, thank you for joining us on Conversations. Once again, Heather Anderson gained her master's from the Department of Community Healthcare Systems at the School of Nursing for the University of Washington in Seattle. She is currently the regional program manager for the AIDS Education and Training Center at the University of Washington. I'm Susan McInnes for Conversations, and I hope you'll join us again next week.